Welcome to the Gold Collar Investor Podcast with your host, Pancham Gupta. This podcast is dedicated to helping the high-paid professionals to break out of the Wall Street investments and create multiple income streams. Here is your host, Pancham Gupta.
Hi, this is Russell Gray, co-host of the Real Estate Guys radio show, and you are listening to the Gold Collar Investor Podcast.
Welcome to the Gold Collar Investor Podcast. This is Pancham. If this is your first time listening, then thanks for coming. The Gold Collar Investor Podcast is produced every week for your learning and enjoyment. I want to remind you that if you're not part of the Gold Collar Investor private Facebook group, you can do so by going to the goldcollarinvestor.com/FB group. I repeat, the goldcollarinvestor.com/FB group. Now let's get into the show. Are retail malls a thing of the past? What about the small retail strip malls that you see in your neighborhood? The ones which have your local pharmacy, maybe a barber shop and a restaurant that you like. Being in the tech world, I feel that the only experience-related retail centers will survive, and anything that can be commoditized will be commoditized. For example, if you have to experience a nice outing and enjoy a great meal, you will go to a restaurant, or if you want to get a haircut, you will go out and find a barber shop. Things like that will be here to stay. Rest all will be online. Wanting to learn more and explore this field, retail investing a little bit more, I have invited Michael Flight, who is an expert in this space and has been in retail real estate for 34 years and has handled more than half a billion, that is $500 million worth of real estate transactions. Hey, Mike, welcome to the show.
Hi, Pancham. Thanks for inviting me on. Really appreciate it.
No, thanks for your time. Are you ready to fire up my listeners' break out of Wall Street investments?
I am so ready to fire them up to break out of Wall Street investments because I've never believed in the Wall Street casino culture. And I can tell you how angry I was that initially when I, you know, had a SEP IRA and I had my pension plan and other things, and the only options I had was investing in Wall Street. And I can tell you that I've been through some major ups and some major downs. And then the best one is my brother was working for a division of AT&T at the time, like 1999. Oh, and he says, oh, you should see how great this stock is exploding. And so I jump into it like 2 months later, the dot-com bubble busts. The thing went to like 50 cents. So wow. And I held onto it for a few years just because it's like, well, it's already sunk cost and it never came back. So, and I've never, ever had that happen with a real estate investment. So I'm not too excited about Wall Street because I don't have a whole lot of control over it. You know, even when they say passive, it's like up and down and up and down. And then the same issue I had with, I was forced into investments with my kids' 529 plans. And, you know, that whole thing imploded. And, you know, I basically lost close to 40%, it went down 60%.
I see.
Not a huge fan of Wall Street investing.
Well, we'll discuss now what you do. And with that, do you want to give us an overview of how and what you do and your background?
Sure. My name is Michael Flight with Concordia Realty. We founded Concordia Realty in 1990, and I've been in the real estate business and the commercial real estate business particularly, investing in and redeveloping and leasing and doing just about everything you can with retail real estate, which includes shopping centers. We've done enclosed malls, larger enclosed malls. And we also do what are called net lease properties or single tenant lease properties or just the letters NNN. And that's where we're concentrating on moving forward is the single tenant net lease properties.
Got it. Got it. So, you know, my listeners, some of them actually never heard of this term called net lease or NNN. So what does that mean? And also, The second question is, can you explain how does this retail, when you talk about retail center, what do you mean?
Okay, so there's a division all under the category of retail real estate. There's a number of different things. So you've got from the very smallest, which is a single tenant building that you might see a grocery store, you might see a Dollar General, you might see a Walgreens. That would be a single tenant and more than likely a net lease property. And we'll get into that in a little bit. Then you've got the next category up, which is a strip center. And you've got a bunch of different types of strip centers, all the way from a grocery anchored strip center to, you know, a large size, what they call power center, which is a bunch of larger big box tenants. And they call them big box because they're large, like a Best Buy, like a Bed Bath & Beyond, and they specialize in a particular thing. And then if you go up even larger than that, you get into an enclosed mall or a regional shopping center. And so those go all the way up. And some of the highest volume and highest sales volumes are in regional malls. So there's, you guys out in New Jersey have some really good regional malls, like the malls at Short Hill and some of those other ones. And those are just power, what they call fortress malls. Those are going to be around. And then there's going to be a lot of smaller malls that have weak anchor tenants. And going forward, those malls more than likely won't be around and will be repurposed, redeveloped, or just, you know, sit vacant because retail is changing.
Got it. So to kind of summarize what you just said, so we have single tenants like Walgreens, and that's the only tenant in that particular location. And moving up from that, we have kind of like strip centers where you have multiple places anchored by one or two of these big box guys. And after that, we have like full-blown retail malls, you know, so kind of three broad categories. Got it.
That is correct. And then to circle back to the net part of it,
right?
All retail, or almost all retail, I should say, but if you're operating a retail property correctly, a shopping center or a single tenant or a mall, they're net leases, so that the tenant signs a longer term lease, anywhere from 5 to, we've done, you know, 30-year leases, and the tenant is responsible for most of the expenses. So the tenant is automatically responsible for paying their own utilities. The tenant is automatically responsible for paying their own garbage. But then if you get a single net lease, that means that the tenant is paying responsible also for paying the real estate taxes. If you get a double net lease, that would be NN. The tenant is responsible for paying the real estate taxes and the insurance. And if you get a triple net lease, the tenant is responsible for paying the real estate taxes, the insurance, and all the maintenance. And then you get into a pure triple. So there's a difference. Sometimes, like in shopping centers, because there's a common roof and there's common walls in between and stuff. Mm-hmm. So it's not a pure triple net lease, but the tenant is responsible for paying real estate taxes, insurance for the building, liability insurance for the common areas in the parking lot. They pay for snow plowing, they pay for, you know, maintenance of the facade. But the landlord would end up paying for the structure of the building and the roof. In some of the buildings that you see, like a Dollar Tree freestanding or a Walgreens or a CVS freestanding, the tenant, or, you know, the biggest ones are like Chick-fil-A and, mm-hmm. you know, McDonald's and all those guys, or an AutoZone. If they're freestanding, a lot of times they're not only responsible for everything, they're also responsible for the building.
Oh, got it.
So they pay for the roof and the structure and everything else. All you do is collect the check.
Got it. So I'm sure like we have three ends, right? And would you say the McDonald's and Chick-fil-A is like four ends or three and a half ends, something like that?
No. It's unfortunately, even though we say that shopping centers are triple net lease, they're really just a kind of a double net lease. And so it's an NN. And then the guys that are out there, they're full triple net. So, and the net is that you've got in a, like, for example, you do apartment buildings, you've got your gross income, and then you've got your net operating income. Well, they pay for a lot of the nets. And so you just get, you know, basically a net operating income and you don't have to pay expenses. That's where the nets come from.
Got it.
So it's the difference between a gross lease, which you get gross income, mm-hmm. and a net lease where, you know, the tenants pay for all that and you end up getting just a net income.
Got it. So you obviously would know as the owner of the strip mall or these places, how much are those expenses? Would it be you or would it be the tenant who would be hiring these services?
It really depends on what the lease says. So just to educate your listeners a little more, these leases are complex financial instruments. So the apartment leases are pretty long, but if you're doing a lease and getting married to somebody for, you know, 5 years up to 20, 25, and like I said, I've had a 30-year lease and then a string of options so that the lease could have extended up to 60 years. That's a long time to live with somebody. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of things that the tenant wants and there's a lot of things that the landlord wants. But some of the leases, the landlord is responsible for arranging for the parking lot to be swept and, you know, different things. And then they bill it back to the tenant. That's a little bit more involved. In other situations, and even in most single net leases, if it's a freestanding building, the tenant pays the real estate taxes directly to, you know, whatever municipality or county or who's ever, you know, charging for the real estate taxes. So you're aware and you want to make sure, and as part of your management, like a lot of people say, oh, these things are management free. It's like, no, you still have to check and make sure that the tenant paid their real estate taxes, you know, because otherwise, if you've got debt on the property, your lender is going to put you in default, even though the tenant was supposed to pay them.
Right.
So there's stuff that you do have, and you do have to make sure that even if they're responsible for plowing the snow, you have to make sure that they do plow the snow with insurance, no matter what type of retail you have. As part of your property management, you need to go and request an insurance certificate and make sure the insurance certificate lists you, the owner, as an additional insured, and you're covered with all this stuff too.
Got it. So you specifically, your company, do you do mainly triple net or single net or double net or all of them?
We try to put as much of the uncontrollable expenses onto the tenant because that just smooths out your income and it's one less thing because, you know, real estate taxes, nobody knows how high they're going to go up. So if I don't have to worry about that. But conversely, especially in the single tenant stuff, you don't get as high returns as you do because you're not taking as much risk like you would be with a hotel or an apartment building. It's more like a bond return because you know exactly what you're going to get. There's this agreement and you're doing an agreement and, you know, Walgreens, Dollar Tree, Dollar General, and, you know, McDonald's, Chick-fil-A, those guys are investment grade credit. So you're basically buying a bond. But the other great thing about it is you get a tangible asset. And so your value, the value of your building is based on that lease. It's not based on what some bond trader in New York or Singapore or, you know, London decides the value of those bonds are today.
Yep. Yeah, got it. So like, how do you classify these strip malls? Is it what you just explained, the triple net or double net or single net? Are those the classification or, you know, in apartment buildings, we have a class A, class B, class C, or in self-storage, we have five or mobile home parks, five star, four star. Do we have something like that in retail centers?
The large enclosed malls are more classified from A being your fortress mall, your best mall, your, you know, like a Tyson's Corner in, you know, Arlington, Virginia.
Got it.
And it's the Forum Shops at Caesars. And those are malls that are just like super huge producers. And there's one in, I think it's the Alamona Mall in Hawaii. And those malls are some of the best malls in the world. And those are always going to be Class A. In strip centers, there's not as much of a classification. It mainly depends on who the anchor tenants are. So do you have powerful anchor tenants? Do you have tenants that anchor tenants that are going to bring in traffic to your shopping center? Because the whole point of having a shopping center is everybody does better. You know, if you've got the anchor and you've got the other tenants feeding off of it, if you've got the other specialty tenants bringing in people that then they go shop at the anchor. So there's a cross shopping. And so in a shopping center, there's an art to merchandising your shopping center. But there's also different things as to what is a good shopping center or a bad shopping center. The biggest thing with a shopping center is visibility, traffic, and access. And the next biggest thing is your anchor tenants and then the demographics surrounding your area. So if you've got really low-end demographics and working-class demographics, you're going to hope that you've got some higher population densities to offset the lower spending power. But you've also, and people might say, well, I want high-end demographics. Well, if you've got like a low-end tenant, they're not going to do well in the high-end area. And conversely, I get a lot of municipalities that say, oh, we want a Neiman Marcus here. We want the latest and greatest. I can't, you know, a Gucci or a Pucci or a Sushi here. It's like, well, you know, your demographics are working class, middle income to lower income. And you've got a large representation of specific ethnic groups here. So you're not going to get those tenants there. But we can, if it's a Hispanic market, we're a great traffic driver is, you know, a Hispanic grocery store. And there's a ton of great Hispanic grocery store chains. And the same thing is like there's some very good Asian specialty stores. Like my favorite grocery store in the world is H Mart, you know, and it's a Korean grocery store. Right. And then, you know, there's Patel Brothers and just different things. And so if you've got that type of demographic in your neighborhood, it's like you might actually be better off putting one of those guys in and really drive a lot of traffic than putting in, you know, your run-of-the-mill Kroger or your run-of-the-mill
ShopRite or...
Yeah, ShopRite. Right. Yeah, ShopRite or something like that.
Right.
And then you have one of the best grocers in the world out by you, Wegmans. Wegmans is also a fantastic grocery store. So
Got it. So what kind of things you need to be careful about when you invest in these shopping centers, like as an active guy or as a passive investor? Like what would you, like key things that you look at?
If you're a passive investor, you're going to want to make sure that the company that you're working with has knowledge of this. You don't want them to be working on their first shopping center. Or if they are working on their first shopping center, you want them to have, you know, a background of a few years in the industry, because it's really about tenant relationships. Because the key driver of all your income is leasing, as you know, with apartments. But the leasing that's in retail is driven by relationships with national tenants and regional tenants and local tenants. So you want somebody that has relationships, or if you are going to invest yourself, you're going to want to, you know, get some relationships with some of those people, or, you know, get somebody like a broker or a property manager that has some of those relationships if it's your first venture. Number two, like I said, you want to make sure that there's access, because all the time you want to make sure as much as possible that there's left and right turns in and out. You want to make sure that there's traffic. You want to make sure that you can see the tenant signs, because if the tenants, you can't see the tenant signs, the tenants aren't going to go there. Mm-hmm. The tenants also aren't going to go there if there's no access. And like I say, you also want to be careful about your merchandising, because you don't want to, like, say you've got a vacant space and you've got a TJ Maxx and you've got, you know, like a party store and you've got, you know, a supermarket and you've got this vacant space that you really want to lease, and along comes like a marijuana dispensary or like a porn shop. That is really going to change the nature of your shopping center. So even though the marijuana dispensary is legal, and even though the marijuana dispensary might pay a lot of money to be there, those other tenants aren't going to want to be next to them. And you also want to make sure that there's enough parking. So a lot of national tenants like Ross and Marshalls and those guys will put restrictions on who you can put next to them, because they don't want a health club next to them where people are just going to kind of go there, park for an hour or two, and then just get back in their car and leave because they're all sweaty after they went to the health club, or, you know, they're tired and they don't necessarily cross shop.
I see.
It's a little bit, like I said, a little bit of an art and some science to, you know, leasing. But the main thing is having a location. We call the best location out there the main and main location. So that's what really differentiates shopping centers. If you've got one shopping center that's got the good tenants and it's on the corner with all full access, that's your A-class shopping center. Mm-hmm. And you could have the next shopping center right next to it. But if it's off the intersection, it's necessarily going to be a B-class shopping center, because all your best tenants are going to want to be right at Main and Main.
Got it. Got it.
We get back to Wall Street because this is literally Main Street investing.
Right. So, you know, what kind of, again, I'm going to ask a very general question. What kind of returns, like investors, we're talking in 2020 and we'll get into like post-COVID situation. But in general, like what kind of returns people have, you can get as compared to, you know, let's say apartments or self-storage or mobile home park? Are they higher or lower or similar?
It's really hard to say.
I see.
We've traditionally, up until a few years ago, specialized in value add deals. Mm-hmm. And so we were getting some really nice returns. And also from about 2010 on, unless you were brain dead, you know, most of the time, it was pretty easy. And you had to get a good shopping center too. The one thing is that with apartments, you can kind of improve them and do different things to make them better. There's some shopping centers that will never, ever be a good shopping center. So you should just avoid them, you know, and it's just the location is bad, the access is bad, and all the rest. I explain to people all the time, if a retailer can't make sales, it really doesn't matter, because they'll be losing a lot more money than just paying you rent. So it's all about whether a retailer can make sales. So you can actually give them the space and pay them to take the space, and they'll still lose money because they've got to keep their store open.
Right.
So that's why you see so many in certain situations where a lot of tenants will close a location, continue to pay rent, and move, you know, someplace else and open up a bigger store or a different store or a better location.
Wow. Amazing. I have never thought of that. They will keep paying the rent. And
well, they're obligated to pay the rent. So they'll continue to pay the rent. And as long as they don't have what's called a radius restriction, they'll just move to a new location that's a better location where they can make money. Or they'll just, if it's just a bad location overall and they don't think that they want to put a store into that market, they'll just close the store because it's cheaper for them just to sit there and pay rent on that store and move on with their business in other areas.
I see. So, you know, I want to switch gears a little bit, and being an engineer from, you know, my background is engineering, and I've been into tech space for a very long time. And, you know, with the advent of Amazon, I've been hearing for last decade that retail is dead, right? Like, you know, the malls are going to go away. That's everything is going to be online. It was supposed to be online in 99. You know, there was, you could get your groceries, you know, online. You're going to get your pets delivered online. Everything was supposed to be online in 99, right? Dot-com bubble. And that was then, and now we are in 2020. You know, some of that has come about, that has become true, and we are not at the level of drone deliveries that Amazon has been proposing. But we are hit with the situation of coronavirus, which has led to like closures across the, you know, industries. And I'm sure retail, hospitality, everyone is getting hit bad, right? So, like, what do you see the future of retail strip centers in the face, let's say, right before coronavirus hit? What was your take, and what is your take now with that situation we have on our hands right now?
Well, the prediction, and it appeared, because pure play internet retailers have a lot of expenses to drive traffic to their websites. So, and They've got the additional expense of delivery. They've got the additional expense of people ordering a bunch of stuff just to try it on and then buying the one thing and returning, you know, maybe four other items. So it's really hard to make a living doing as a pure internet play. And Amazon found that out. So Amazon went and bought Whole Foods.
Mm-hmm.
And Amazon had been, up until March, opening up stores, their Amazon Go stores. They were even opening up Amazon bookstores. And so the market was changing to what was called omnichannel. And the biggest part of omnichannel is what they call BOPIS, which is buy online, pick up at store, or pick up in store. And so that was a super huge thing that was even changing the way restaurants do things. So I was just talking to, we're working out a deal where we're giving a rent break to a Longhorn Steakhouse, which is part of Darden. And, you know, they've got over 800 landlords. They've got thousands of restaurants, and they had already started doing pickup windows because there was a lot of people that just wanted to order and pick it up. And you can see it in with Chili's was doing a big part of that. Right. And so people that in the restaurant business were doing a lot of pickup, even if they had a sit down type of a restaurant like a Longhorn Steakhouse or an Olive Garden or something like that. Mm-hmm. So the market was kind of going to omnichannel, where you could buy online, you could buy in the store, or you could order it and then pick it up at the store. And you wouldn't have to go into the store even. And Walmart was really good. They turned on a dime, you know, and as soon as they saw the threat from Amazon, you know, I never would bet against Walmart because they just are huge. They've got sharp people and they've got a ton of money to spend.
Mm-hmm.
So, but Amazon can probably match them dollar for dollar, but we'll go into that later. That's the way the market was going. There was some winners, there was some losers, and there was people like Ross that didn't even develop their website, their online sales, because a large majority of their customers didn't, you know, they paid in cash or paid with a debit card. A lot of their customers were lower income, and a lot of their customers didn't shop online. So a lot of the news stories that you hear are written in Washington, Chicago, Los Angeles, and major urban areas. But once you get out beyond that, a lot of people aren't buying stuff online, and it gets more difficult to deliver something to the middle of Indiana, as they're finding out now. But I will say that moving forward, there probably will be a lot more online sales taking, a lot more figuring out how to get the merchandise to the customer the way that the customer wants the merchandise. But I still think at the end of the day, we're social animals. We want to go out. It's going to be difficult to stop us from going out. We're going to go to the mall. We're going to, you know, at some point maybe go to movie theaters. I don't know how they're going to, that's going to be something that's going to be a really difficult
right.
situation.
Yeah.
We're still going to want to go to bars and all the rest of it. And if and when they get the vaccine for this thing, you know, everything will be normal, but there'll be definite changes. But I think at the end of the day, there's certain things that you want to touch, that you want to feel, that you want to have the experience. And if you have a very good experience and you have, you know, people that know how to sell in your store, you're going to have that experience. And then you're going to have the dollar stores. And what we've been focusing on is the single tenant dollar stores, the single tenant drug stores and pharmacies, because they not only act as healthcare providers, they also act as convenience stores and mini grocery stores. And they're doing a lot of the same thing that the dollar stores are doing. The dollar stores are, you know, mini type of Walmart things. And a lot of times they're in small towns that don't have any type of, so that's their only general store that they have. We really like the service providers. We love what's called MedTail, which is your dentist, your urgent care place.
Right.
We love the dialysis places because people absolutely 100% need to do the dialysis. And DaVita and Fresenius are both Fortune 500 companies and excellent credit. And we really like the auto service places like your Jiffy Lube, your gas station.
AutoZone.
Well, I don't really like AutoZone as much as I like people that are doing service, like the oil change, the tire places. We love car washes, those places where, because I think at some point, AutoZone, a lot of that stuff is going to go half online and half offline.
Right.
And so I really like where you have to get your car fixed. And then I, you know, with your technology guys are probably screaming at their iPhone right now saying, oh, but it's all going to go to, you know, everybody's going to drive Ubers or it's going to go to self-driving cars or stuff. It's like, well, at some point, somebody's going to have to service that stuff.
Right.
No matter what it is.
Right. So like what you're saying is, in summary, that anything that's experience related, whether it is going and eating food outside and having a good time, or, you know, having something like a barber shop, which is again experience related, you cannot get your haircut online. You have to have
right.
someone like that. Or, you know, if you have things like, you know, servicing your car, whether it's the car wash or fixing it and all that. So all that is going to remain, and like really nothing, it's going to be very hard to touch those things. And as far as other online retail is concerned.
Yeah, I'll just make one caveat though. I don't know how those are going to come back, especially the, you know, the hair care salons, the restaurants and stuff like that. I don't know how they're going to come back after COVID. So they'll probably be a slightly different experience.
Yeah, no, I was about to ask that actually. Yeah, you know, based on what you just said, that was like pre-COVID. But now, given the COVID situation, right, what would you say, like the impact to your portfolio or people you know, their portfolio, and how is it going to move forward?
Well, we're right now in the middle of a situation, and I was just mentioning to you that we've got, you know, a number of shopping centers where up to 40-45% of the tenants are not paying any rent or anything because they're completely closed. And so it's some of them are claiming a force majeure. Some of them are rightfully saying that it's more along the lines of a government eminent domain, that, you know, the government closed them down so they don't have any control over it and they can't open up.
Right.
But we had been kind of moving away from a lot of that model anyways. And we've been putting together a fund that has single tenant uses that weren't going to be disintermediated by the internet. And so they're more service uses. So we're looking at investing in auto service. We're looking at investing in MedTail. We're looking at investing in drugstores and dollar stores. And then with a small smattering of funeral homes if they were well located in a retail setting. So those are all things that are, number one, they've got some pretty good credit behind them because they're either good Fortune 500 credit, you know, credit rated tenants, or they're high net worth business owners or franchise owners that, you know, have a number of stores, or they're high net worth doctors and dentists. And so we like that model there. And what we're putting together, and we still are, is a portfolio that's geographically diversified, that's credit diversified, and is, you know, pretty much, I don't want to say recession proof, but extremely recession resistant.
Got it. Okay.
And also, it's proven out. Our investment thesis is proven out because it's pretty COVID resistant too.
Oh, that's great.
And then the other cool thing that your guys, if they're tech guys, are going to love is we are right now investigating doing that in a security token offering.
Oh, no. You're actually putting everything on blockchain?
We'd like to. We're trying to.
Oh, you are. That's great. Yeah. I would love to chat with you offline on that and find more details. Well, great. Thank you, Mike, for all the knowledge that you've shared. So we'll be back after this message.
If you are an accredited investor and have been thinking about putting your money to work for you, then I have a good news for you. I have created an investor club, which I call the Gold Collar Investor Club. I will be putting together investing opportunities exclusively for the group. These are the opportunities where I have done the due diligence for you and will be investing my own money alongside you. If you are interested, please sign up on thegoldcollarinvestor.com/club. I repeat, thegoldcollarinvestor.com/club. I will reach out to schedule a 30-minute phone conversation to discuss your investing goals once you sign up. this can be a good opportunity to diversify and take some chips off the hands of Wall Street to produce some passive income. And in case you are wondering, what is an accredited investor? Accredited investor is someone who has earned more than $200,000 as filing single or more than $300,000 filing jointly for last 2 years. Another way to qualify as an accredited investor is if your total net worth is more than $1 million, excluding your personal home. It includes your stocks, 401ks, IRAs, cars, etc., just not the equity in your personal home. If this is you, I would highly encourage you to sign up. Let's move on to the next section of the show, which I call Taking the Leap Round. I ask these four questions to every guest on my show. So Mike, my first question for you is, when was the first time you invested outside of Wall Street?
Well, I was, I think, either a senior in college or just had graduated from college. I can't remember what the year was, but my brother and I bought a three-flat apartment building, and that was our first investment outside of Wall Street.
Okay, wow. How long ago was that?
That was like 1985 or 1986.
Wow.
And I was around 20, 21 years old.
Wow. That's great. Cool. So what fears did you have to overcome when you did that, when you first invested outside of Wall Street? Did you have any fears? People usually in college don't.
Yeah, I was so young and stupid that I didn't really know the difference between investing in Wall Street. And I really at the time wasn't interested in anything Wall Street because I didn't have any money to invest in Wall Street. But my brother and I could get a FHA loan with very little down and, you know, control a building that at the time we bought it, I think it was like $80,000, $90,000. And, you know, so you can make close to $100,000 investment. And I think we put a total of $2,000 into it.
Wow. Got it. Cool. So my third question is, can you share with us one investment that did not go as expected?
I can say that we've had a lot that didn't go as expected.
Oh, really?
But the thing is that we've always managed to overcome them. We've never, ever given a property back in our 30-year history. We've had situations where our investors did not make as much money as they could have, but our investors have never lost their principal. So the worst one I ever did was when we put together a fund and raised money from Canadian institutional investors right after the 2008 crash, and we were buying single-tenant portfolios of homes, redoing them, and then flipping them and selling them or renting them. And my biggest problem was trusting a contractor that he was doing what he said he was doing. And so we got out ahead on the payments for him, and then he just kind of disappeared. So, yeah, that's, you know, and it was something that we should have known, but he was also a brother-in-law of one of the partners. So, no, he was actually a brother. So he was a brother of one of the partners. And you figure that he's not going to screw his own brother, but evidently this guy, you know, was a really low life. So.
Wow. No, you know, as they say, you do and you learn, and we call these seminars. So, you know, one more thing that you don't have, that you would not.
I absolutely, you know, I don't care who you are now. It's like, if you're putting in a request for payment on a construction project, we're going to go through lien waivers, and somebody's going to go out there and sign off on the fact that the work is done and all the rest of it. So lesson learned. And it was something that we should have known in the first place, but sometimes you get lazy.
Yeah, no, you do and you learn. Cool. So my last question for you, Mike, is what is one piece of advice would you give to people who are thinking of investing in Main Street, that is outside of Wall Street?
I would say that, you know, come on over here. The returns are much more stable, whether you're talking about apartments, whether you're talking about triple net stuff, whether you're talking about industrial buildings, whether you're talking about cell towers. I mean, this is where you can get some real stability, some real wealth creation. And especially if you're looking at the market up and down, I get really scared when my entire investment, you know, it depends on what type of tweet the president makes. I get really scared whether there's a tsunami someplace or whether there's a virus. I mean, we're getting hit with it now, but just the market plunging for some reason that doesn't have anything to do with what you're doing in the middle of the country. So I really like the fact, especially with what we're doing longer term leases. I also like what you guys are doing because people always need a place to live. They need a roof over their head. And so we're, you know, me and you are kind of in the same business that we're providing goods and services to people that people need. You're providing, you know, roof and shelter for people that they absolutely need. So, I mean, those are your basic Maslow's hierarchy of needs.
Right. Well, great. Thank you for that advice. So, Mike, this has been great. Thank you for your time. How can the listeners reach you if they want to get in touch with you?
Sure. They can go to our website. It's ConcordiaRealty.com. That's ConcordiaRealty.com. Or they can send me an email directly at mflight@ConcordiaRealty.com. We are going to have more information about our new security token fund. We're putting the website together and getting the legal documents put together. But that's going to be libertyfund.io. That's libertyfund.io.
Got it. Great. Well, thank you, Mike, for your time today.
Thank you.
I hope that you guys enjoyed that show and got some perspective on retail centers. Thanks for listening. If you have questions, email me at p@thegoldcollarinvestor.com. That's P as in Paul at thegoldcollarinvestor.com. This is Pancham signing off. Until next time, take care.
Thank you for listening to the Gold Collar Investor Podcast. If you love what you've heard and you want more of Pancham Gupta, visit us at www.thegoldcollarinvestor.com and follow us on Facebook at The Gold Collar Investor. The information on this podcast are opinions. As always, please consult your own financial team before investing.